Okay. Hi. Want to thank everybody for making it over here, and I don't think we lost anybody, so that's good. Thanks for coming here. And there's a sign-up sheet, so make sure you sign that today for the people who are taking the class. Want to say that on Tuesday we're going to have another experiment. We're going to have a webinar from my colleague up in Spokane. He's going to be talking about a device that he's actually developed at the VA, actually right over there when I was working there, that addresses the communication need of people with aphasia. And so it'll be quite interesting. Hope everybody will be looking forward to that. Any other questions or comments before we start? Okay. We're going to get going real quickly because we got a lot to see, and I know some people have to leave early. So if you do have to leave early, you're excused. Leave whenever you have to. Thanks for coming. So today I want to thank our host, Graham Creasy, for having us over here. And this has worked out really well last year, so I'm sure it'll work out good this year. Dr. Creasy is the Paralyzed Veterans of America Professor of Spinal Cord Injury at Stanford, and he's the Chief of Spinal Cord Injury here at the VA, and he's been here about 2 years now, but he has a wealth of experience in this area, and this is really a treat to for us to for him to give us time to talk about stuff. His interests include the restoration of function after spinal cord injury, obviously, and also using information technology and biotechnology to help folks with spinal cord injury. So please welcome Graham Creasy.
Thank you, David. You may not all know, but actually David and I have known each other for at least 20 years, I guess. 24, 25. And I've known Maurice and Ingrid for between 2 and 3 decades, I think. Because, as you can tell from my accent, I used to be in Britain. I went to medical school in Edinburgh, in Scotland, where we've had dinner together and met at lots of conferences. But I used to come over to this part of the world as often as I could, starting in about the mid-80s. There was a conference here, the Rehab Engineering Society of North America. And I rather got to like the weather in California compared to Scotland. But also, I particularly came here, and I used to more or less treat this place as Mecca. I used to come here whenever I came to the States. I'd try and get out to the West Coast, and I'd try and get to Palo Alto, and I'd try and get to the VA, and I'd try and get to Building 51. And Building 7, because there was so much cool stuff happening. And you were in Building 7, Rehab R&D Center, and I think, Maurice, you were at Children's Hospital. And so I would come across from Edinburgh and make a beeline to try and get out to this part of the world and see what cool stuff was being done, because there was a remarkable amount of interesting things being done on technology for disability. I came from a family where my father was an engineer who would have liked to be a doctor. I became a doctor who would have liked to be an engineer. But the point is, really, you need both. And you can't always have both in the same person. Occasionally you can, but mostly people specialize and they're good at one or the other. So that usually means you have to collaborate. And so clinical people have to collaborate with technical people. And that goes for a lot of the design and use of technology for working with disabilities as well, because sometimes people naively think that you can invent some gadget and it'll solve all the problems. But it all depends on the design of the gadget. You probably saw the launch yesterday of the Apple iPad, and there's been a great debate about, is there a place for a tablet in between the cell phone and the laptop? And a lot of people have tried to make tablets, and just throwing hardware at a problem doesn't necessarily solve the problem. And you really have to take account of what it is people want to do and what are the social, emotional, cultural needs, and then you have to design to meet those, because if you don't, you won't have a market. The thing isn't going to be used or bought or sold. And so there's a long tradition, which some of you may be familiar with, of socio-technical design. And I don't know if you talk about this in the course, but looking back over the last century, at least 100 years, people realized that in designing systems, especially that involve technology, you need the socio piece as, at least as much as you need the technical piece. And there are lots of examples of that. People assuming that if you just invent a gadget and throw it at the problem, it'll solve the problem. But you really have to have a sound understanding of how people work and how people want to work and what they want to do. And you can't just go and ask them. They don't always know. You have to use anthropological methods like observing them, ethnography. And some of these techniques come into market research, and they come into Stanford's biodesign course. And the whole art of assessing the need before you jump in and with a solution. Because otherwise, the sort of occupational hazard in designing these devices is we have this great solution. You spent years, months developing a solution, and when you finally developed it, then you go around saying, does anybody have a problem that will match this solution? We have this great solution. Somebody must need it. I'm sure somebody, please, could somebody use my gadget? And so it's very disappointing.
A lot of times, you know, the engineer who develops something will say, wow, this is such a, I'm so proud of myself for doing such a great design. I'm sure that people will want to use it. Time and time again, people, they designed it for what they think other people will want. And it's when it gets to the point of having people actually use it, they don't use it, they reject it.
Right. So you have to sort of get away from what you think people want and find out what they actually want. Or more importantly, what they need. Because they may think they want it, but they may not actually need that. They may need something a little different. So it's just a principle of successful design to sort of really figure out what the problem is before you see what the solutions are going to match. So we can talk about this some more, but I thought we don't want to spend all the time talking. If you've come all the way to the hospital, we should go and see some stuff. We can talk anywhere. So let's go see some stuff, and then we can come back here and talk about it to whatever time you have. But we'll just walk around, see a few things. Some things start to close up in government employment at about 4:30. So some people will be leaving work already. But we can see some of the technology and some of the clinical situation and then come back. Feel free to ask questions as you go. This is intended to be entirely informal and interactive. And the best learning is usually informal. So feel free to talk as you go and ask questions. So we'll head on down first and go to see, and there's just no particular order, it really just depends on who's available at this time of the day and who we can go and see, in some cases people, some cases just technology, and then we can come back and try and put some of the pieces together.
Okay. Mr. Harvard, how you doing?
Oh, never been to Harvard, but I'm doing
all right. Let's do this way. Should we go this way? Yeah, come on down. As you go, you'll just keep your eyes open for technology and gadgets. We can come back and look at some of them in more detail, but everywhere you go in a place that's devoted to people who've broken their neck or broken their back or become paralyzed, there's technology of all kinds. I mean, this kind of thing. Can David? Where's David? There you are. Do you want to tell us about this briefly?
Well, I'm not sure about this one, but it's a backboard system typically used for evacuating a person from a site of injury to a hospital on a helicopter or some other conveyance. And I know at the R&D center, we actually looked at adding on a spinal stabilization tensioning mechanism. And we made one out of fiberglass, but this is nice. It has to be strong and flexible and radio transparent as well, because it needs to go into the X-ray room.
And this was developed in Building 7, wasn't it? And
I'm not sure that particular one, but the concept. Ideas for that.
So as a way of we keep it here and we stash them in on the wall here, because if somebody has a cardiac arrest and we have to get them off of the bed onto a cart and take them to intensive care unit, we just pull it off the wall and we slide them. We can use it to slide them from the bed onto a cart or for any kind of urgent transfer. So they're readily available. But what you might notice about it is how simple it is. And this is really simple technology. And very often simple solutions are the ones that last. But getting it... Go ahead.
What is this made out of?
This is made out of...
Some kind of plastic.
Something hard, shiny. And you want it shiny so that you can slide, so the sheets and the patient's pajamas slide across it, so you don't shear the skin and damage it.
Washable as well. So there's lots of properties that go into selecting material for this.
So when you get a good solution, you often boil it down to the essentials, real simple. Enough handholds that several people can hold on to take the weight of the patient. You actually lift the patient on. You slide the patient onto this, and then people can just use it as a stretcher and carry the patient. And if we have an earthquake, we may have to carry people out on these. And just enough people gathered around, you can carry it. So really a very simple piece, but probably went through a few design stages just to get it simpler and simpler and functional. But the nice thing is that having done that, it's part of the furniture. It's here for good, and it's here, it's used whenever we have cardiac arrests or emergencies, and if we ever have an earthquake. So it's actually found its way into practical use rather than sitting in a cupboard somewhere. But as you go down the hall, you'll see other bits and pieces of technology. Just keep your eyes open. The Ambu bag, again, for emergencies, for helping somebody breathe. A blue bag on the wall. You connect it up to a tube in the throat or a tracheostomy. All just part of the environment, part of the furniture. Yes. Yes, or high IQ.
There you go.
And often it takes more smarts to get to the simpler solution. That's the art of engineering,
exactly.
That anybody can make something complicated.
Exactly.
It takes a smart guy to make something simple.
Exactly. And this is
one design budget. Yes. And if you want them to be widely used, they need
exactly.
to be used by many people. So... So we're heading down just to the driving simulator, and that's just down the hall down here, and then we'll come back.
I'm responsible for that.
Yes, well, you can introduce. Mark Samuelson's going to be there.
I'm not sure I know him other than last year.
Yes, but he agreed to give us a whirl on that. May we join you? Yeah, thank you. Come on in to this room here. Come on in so we can get everybody in. Oh, yeah. Do you remember David Jaffe?
Yes.
Mark Samuelson? David's around, of course.
My class at Stanford.
Which is the adaptive technology?
It's called Perspectives in Assistive Technology, and they serve this line.
And so we've got about 15, 16 people.
Maybe a few more
joined us. See if we can get in. Come on over so we can squeeze in. Come on over. Let everybody in. And I don't know. It's okay, we can.
All right, so, describe. And a little bit about
David, what would you like to...
I'll let you basically give an overview.
Okay.
Maybe, you know, 5 minutes or something.
Okay.
Come on in. And you may also know, I don't know if you know Dr. LeBlanc, who... Mark Samson runs our driving simulator. Yeah. Go ahead,
Mark. Actually, I run the driving program with Broad as well. The simulator is just part of what we do, but since we're here for adaptive technology, my name is Mark. I'm an occupational therapist. I'm also a CDRS, Certified Driving Rehab Specialist. And what that means is I work with people on all the units, including spinal cord injury, traumatic brain injury, polytrauma, the dementia programs. So it can be cognitive or physical, for whatever reason they're unable to drive. So what we do here is, in this particular clinic, this is the simulators, obviously. This one is for people who are physically able. That one over there is actually elevates and goes down and is equipped with, I believe, 5 different hand controls now. So we can try out multiple hand controls before I put them in one of our adaptive vehicles. We also have a sedan, 2 minivans, a full-size van, and a truck, all of which can be modified for different adaptive needs. So, I mean, only in the VA will you find that sort of selection. Everywhere else, you're lucky to find one minivan, you're golden. So we're very fortunate. This particular system right here is designed for mostly cognitive impairment. We will test somebody. It's actually an actual vehicle. They'll drive the vehicle, and we'll run them through the same sort of course I would do in an actual vehicle, which would be the hospital grounds, residential, complex commercial, all the way up to freeway driving. The vehicle over there, as I mentioned, is equipped with hand controls. That's for someone who's unable to use their legs. And there's different adaptations that can allow you, even with less and less function in your hands and arms, to be able to still interface with the vehicle. And so I'll show a slideshow here of a couple of the technologies, devices we have, and have some examples here as well. This includes things like the tri-pin, if any of you have seen a tri-pin before. For people without finger control, you see the spinner knob, you can pass around to anyone. You can feel free to go through the box. In the box.
Actually, Ed is going to be talking in our class next month. So.
Okay. Good. Oh, over at Stanford.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'll be there as well. Okay.
Okay, great.
So you'll be seeing slides of a lot of this stuff. So that's a tri-pin. Basically, the way it would work is you'd rest your hand in here, and that way I could basically drive pretty much from my shoulder. I don't need wrists, I don't need fingers, I don't need hands. So if I put that into where that spinner knob is, or the suicide knob, for those of the older generation, you can then do all your steering with the one hand, or in this case, the shoulder. On the other side, right on the left, is what is a push, I think that's a push right angle. And that allows you to do gas and brake with your other hand. That can also be fitted with different orthotics. We can even fabricate it directly to your hand and apply it to that. And that way, whatever your contraction is or whatever, you can still interface with that. That can be done as a push, right angle. Push is for the brake, right angle down towards your leg is the gas. It can be push twist, like a motorcycle, so you twist to do the accelerator. You can rock, there's a rocker version, and there's a push pull version. So those are the low tech versions.
The suicide knob used to be the rocker knob.
Sorry?
The suicide knob used to be the neck.
Right, you know the story
of
necking?
Yes.
He's pretty young.
No, I know necking, but you don't hear it a whole lot of it. The suicide doors, too, for scooping up women off the street. Which are actually very handy if you have to load up your manual wheelchair. You have that double door that opens the opposite direction. Mm-hmm. If you hop into your vehicle and you need to load your chair up, you pop the door out, slide it in. So those doors are still very handy. If you go to the King Cabs, things like that on trucks and some vehicles now, if you're in a manual wheelchair and you want to load that up, it makes it a lot easier than having to carry it over your body. This is just a simple button, but with this is called a digitone. We can place this for your head, your leg, anything that can push a button. That will allow you to scroll through what we call auxiliary controls, everything but the gas, brake, and the gears. If you want to switch gears, you click it, it'll give either a word, it'll say right turn signal, left turn signal, shifter, it'll the radio, it can do all your auxiliary controls just through a button. If you get good at it, you don't even need it to say the words, it'll just be a tone. Very often people go dee 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 dee, they know like the fifth tone, they hit it, that's their windshield wipers. Or their lights, on and off. So, the technology is pretty advanced now, what we can do. We don't have chin drive for cars yet, but perspective, as we showed you, standard spare mode. This actually comes all the way up, and that's why you can do the parking brake. We try to do manual controls whenever possible. Higher tech we go, more problems with potentials. So if we go with the controls you have on that vehicle, this is a left gas. So if you don't have your right leg or unable to use your right leg appropriately, you can use this to press your gas pedal. So you're driving all with one leg with the other leg. That's actually the most dangerous piece of equipment I have, because this one you're actually training someone to drive differently with something that they used to do automatically. Instead of this, I very often push for the hand controls. People can learn a new way of doing something as long as you're not changing the way you used to do it with your lower body. So I'm teaching you something brand new, you can learn that. Then we get to higher tech controls. This is an electric gas brake, forward and backwards. And then it has hydraulics that actually push the gas and the brake for you. We have tree seats. This is an air touch. It can be done hydraulically or computer. Anytime you have hydraulics or computers, you have automatic, you have to have extra backup compressors. You have to have backup. If your power goes out on your car, you still need to be able to get to the side of the road. So you have to have a backup battery, backup compressor. It can get fairly expensive. Here's an example. Those are hydraulics. This gentleman's driving with his shoulder. He's positioned in there. He goes in. He has a lockdown system that automatically grabs the chair. There are multiple tie-down systems. The most common is something called an easy lock or a pin system. There's a pin on the bottom of your wheelchair. You glide right in, it clamps it, you're done. You push a button, that releases you, and you can back out. So notice there's not even a steering wheel here. He will be driving. Actually, the headrest also comes out and around. These are all his controls right here. He's driving basically by joystick. Different steering mechanisms. This is the steering wheel. We try to, whenever possible, leave the original devices. You want to have your airbags, you want to have all that stuff intact whenever possible. In this case, the person didn't have the arm range to do this, but they can do this. So that's a steering wheel. That can also be mounted on the floor with a shoe. You can drive with your feet. Tri-pin, same thing, much smaller. We can take away the 4-power steering people had to, you know, really manually turn. We can reduce the steering. We have what's called reduced effort steering. We can reduce it down to zero effort. The only disadvantage to zero effort is, for those of us who drive without thinking about it, you turn the corner, and when you're coming back, it kind of starts pushing its way back. It doesn't push its way back. In zero effort, you turn, you better unwind, and you keep going in a circle. These are lifts for scooters and power chairs and manual chairs. Mounted in the truck bed, mounted in the different vehicles, swing arm lifts, chair topper. This actually opens up. Person gets in the vehicle, and then this will open up. A rope will come down, basically. They hitch it onto their manual chair. It folds their chair, lifts it up, lays it on top of the vehicle. This is where the pin would go in one of those pin drive chairs. Pulls right up. Notice we flattened the door to allow more space for the power chair just to go straight in. This one's for swing out, just different connectors for lockdowns. Examples of some of our patients. This is a 6-way power tourney seat. The way this seat works is you go into the minivan, the seat then backs up, turns around, and goes up and down. You get into it, it turns you back, brings you up to the front. We always, when we have a preference, want you to be in the original manufacturer's seat or something comparable. Driving from the power or manual wheelchair is never recommended, but can be done. It's just not as safe. At this point, there are no mandatory crash criteria for power manual wheelchairs. They are pushing for that. There are some voluntary standards. Those voluntary standards have only been crash tested up to 30 miles per hour, but we'll work on it. As I mentioned, auxiliary controls. What you can do is you can either interface directly with this by touching, or you can have the button. You push one button, and it will scroll through all your options. You select which one you want. Basically, just push the button, you want to go into gear, you want to turn on your windshield wipers, you want to do your turn signals, all of that is right here. That releases, and there's an example of just a place we've mounted a button so someone could bump it with their elbow. Different types of lifts. This is for a magnet. You put the magnet to the very back of the circle, the door opens, the lift comes down, and in you go. This is called an eyebrow. We try not to do those anymore because they leak. But whenever possible, you lower the van, the vehicle inside. because you're always thinking about the person's vision, even if they're the passenger. If we were to just raise up roofs, someone in a wheelchair would not be able to see out of the vehicle. So by dropping the floor, it allows their vision to stay straight, so they're not having to look at the ceiling the whole time. Okay, we can usually drop, most vehicles drop 9 to 12 inches now. It used to be 10. They can get lower now. This is for tie downs. These chairs, you flip this up, flip that up, this whole chair pulls out. The wheelchair can go in. Once again, we try to make everything that can be driven by someone with a disability still accessible for someone without. Okay, you want to try to make it as versatile as possible in case they don't want to drive that day, but they still want to go somewhere. Just some examples of, that's actually one of our vehicles. Notice this comes up and then you seatbelt in. You always want to stick with original strapping. You don't want to try to modify any of the seatbelt systems as much as you can. This seat actually will come out and get her. And you can do it in the driver's seat as well. It'll actually come out, come down, you transfer into it, it lifts you up, trims you up, puts you in the outer position. That is it for the slideshow. I think we're done time-wise. I don't want to grab you guys too long. Sure.
Okay, great.
No problem. Normally, I know you guys are short on time, but some of the time we can get someone on the simulator and give it a shot. Does anyone have any questions? I know I covered a lot of stuff relatively fast. I was told 5 minutes. So.
Can you give me some idea how much a modified
van? Excellent question. Okay. It depends on the modification. I always go, and it's going to sound odd, I always go cheapest. You know, I try to go mechanical. Behind you is the mechanical version because it won't break down. Everything will break down. But it won't break down nearly as quickly as something with a lot of moving parts. They can be hundreds of thousands of dollars.
But more typically?
It's the top. A typical modification to a vehicle, not the vehicle, just the modification, lower the floor, put a lift in, we're talking usually about $26,000. So $26,000 to just make it so you can get inside. Now that doesn't include if you're going to drive it. If you want to drive it, you need the batteries, you need whatever sort of adaptive devices that go in there. That can go up and up and up. We at the VA are blessed in so many ways. Again, any vet can have an evaluation and training, no cost. If they qualify based on their injury, if their disability is directly service-related, the VA will also pay for all those modifications and give them a down payment on a pretty nice vehicle as well. And we'll do that for life, for two vehicles every 4 years. That's the gold ticket that we call the auto grant. But anyone else who is a vet can also have those evaluations done. We make recommendations for the equipment, but we won't pay for the equipment to be installed on everybody, because that would be outrageously expensive. But it's a pretty sweet deal. Plus, we're one of the few programs still in existence. I've been talking to a lot of the other programs, and to be able to get into a simulator or even into an actual modified vehicle nowadays is getting really hard just because of liability. I mean, there's just so many things that can happen wrong. And yes, I have a gas and a brake on my side.
Yeah, I was just wondering, there are these smart cars which hold about a couple of people and so forth, and they're electric. Mm-hmm. I was just wondering if somebody is thinking about a special edition, one of those things that you might call the roadworthy wheelchair or something like that.
They can be modified. I would modify that for a power chair. I don't think it would have the structural stability to hold a very heavy chair.
No.
Plus, the lift itself usually weighs about 250 pounds. Then you've got the wheelchair itself, which usually weighs 300 some odd pounds. Then you have an individual who also weighs something. So all that stuff adds up. Every vehicle can only hold so much weight in itself. And that's a very common problem. A lot of people will buy a vehicle, come to me and go, okay, I got my new vehicle, let's go. And I look at it and I say, no, it just can't handle it. So
they have to have a source wheelchair and destination wheelchair and this thing.
Well, some people do. Normally, we try to minimize that whenever possible. Here at the VA, we're able to make it so they can transport their chair. Sooner they check with me, sooner I can make sure they get the right vehicle the first time.
So quickly, you have names of a few of the suppliers?
NorCal Mobility. NorCal Mobility is one of the big ones, and there's Specialty Works. You can just go under Adaptive Equipment online, you'll find a lot of them out here. NorCal is one of the big ones here, and
Mobility Works.
Yeah, Mobility Works down in San Jose.
Yeah.
Yeah, those are the two big guys. There's many more. We only do business with certain ones, but they have to be certified in their ability to maintain and so forth for us. So we're much more picky. Yeah.
That remote that you mentioned earlier, could you use that to turn on the radio?
Yes. You can do the radio with the buttons, yeah. Not the magnetic on the outside. But yes, you can use it to turn on the radio, you can channel up. You can set them up to do pretty much anything. You can do it with an ECU, an environmental control unit. Plus, you can actually set up an environmental control unit on your wheelchair that will interface with the vehicle. We've got Bluetooth now. You can pretty much do it all.
In fact, some people are thinking wheelchairs are just smart platforms, that you're riding a computer.
Oh, yeah. Well, I've got a patient now who's got a computer that hooks up to her chair, and she can do, you know, surf the web, she can do all that through the wheelchair. She can do anything in her house. You know, like on TV, you've seen those fancy things where, like, on the screen it'll show your house, and it'll show the windows, and they can touch a thing, you know. She does it with her eyes. She can look at it, and by blinking, because it scans her eyes, it will then open her windows in her house, and she doesn't even have to be home.
Crazy.
Yeah. I mean, the technology's there. You know, we can't all afford it, but the technology is there.
Well, there are possibilities for maybe using a virtual reality glove. You have a web that has technical feedback.
Mm-hmm.
So, except it would be you put on about part of the body that can really...
Yeah, and they're using those already. I know the military is using them a lot for trainings. We have a lot of immersive... virtual reality, that they're using the gloves and the helmets to interact with the environment.
Being Silicon Valley, this is a good place to
to
compare ideas and maybe get sponsors, too.
Yeah, and they're happy to have you come by and check it out. You'd be amazed if you call these people up and say, you know, hey, I'd be interested in checking it out. They're usually happy to show it out. Anything else? Remember that?
Well, thank you, Mark. And I should just particularly say that Mark was very willing to do this at short notice, late in the day. So thank you particularly for doing it. Thank you. All right.
This one's actually just on this one. I can email you.
Get out of your way. Let's get this chair out. It's okay.
Ago and working on the first programs for it, so it's nice to see that it's still going strong.
Well, that's the mark of good solutions, that they do keep going. They're not a flash in the pan,
right.
But they become workable, they become usable, they're clinically employed, and getting people out on the street.
Excellent. Everybody in.
So you can recognize this as an occupational therapy and physical therapy department. We deliberately don't have a wall between them. They're not separate departments, they work together. And there's, of course, a huge range of activities in occupational therapy. You know, it started out with simple occupations, you know, basket weaving and embroidery, and it can cover the gamut of anything for recreation, vocational, avocational things. So a huge number of things. So it tends to be that occupational therapists concentrate on the upper limb and physical therapists on the lower limb and mobility. But, say, people aren't divided that way, so we try and work together. And so a lot of it's just for physical therapy on a lot of the benches and things. Then there's all the mobility devices, the wheelchairs and so on, power chairs and manual chairs, different kinds of reclining chairs, stand-up chairs, all the variety of wheelchairs, and the different ways of driving them with different kind of controls that you're probably hearing about. And in the corner there is just some old industrial equipment, bandsaws and things that, you know, people sometimes are taught, would be taught, you know, just for occupational reasons. More often now, people are taught to sit down in front of a computer because the jobs are now more likely to be available in computers. And plus, if you can control a computer, the computer control the bandsaw or any other equipment. So a lot of our emphasis is on getting people to control the computer. So there's a whole range, as you've seen before, from low tech to high tech, and it's not that one is better than the other. The question is, are they appropriate for what you're trying to do? But since you're here, I thought we'd show you one of the high tech things that some of you may have seen before, which comes from Switzerland. You can move this out if you want to. So, can you all see what we're doing here? This device was provided by the VA to all of the 23 spinal cord injury units around the country. It's a robot developed in Switzerland on the concept that if you move limbs in a physiological way, you'll be stimulating sensory nerves in the joints and the soles of the feet and the muscles and skin, and that sensory information going back into the nervous system may influence how the nervous system recovers from an injury. It may affect the formation of synapses and circuits because the nervous system is now known to be more plastic than we thought. It's more adaptable, more changeable. And so the idea is that maybe you can affect the rewiring of the nervous system by practice. I mean, a lot of physical therapy has always been practiced, but this is a more focused practice on specific functions like walking. So the idea is that you wheel your wheelchair up this ramp, and then you get into the device here, and there's a treadmill here, so the treadmill can move, and then you're strapped into the system here. There's a body weight support system, and so this harness will take your weight through these pulleys, and so your weight can be supported. So even if you can't put all the weight on your legs, you can choose how much weight to put on your legs so that you can move them without buckling and start to exercise them. But you may not be able to move them much or at all. And then, so the idea is then that you strap your legs into this robotic system. And so there's a body section here that you're strapped into, and then these parts of the robot correspond to the knees and the ankles and the calf. So you can see how the robot here has a hip and a knee. And so there are motors you can hear in there. And so if you're strapped into this system, this is strapped against your thighs, strapped against your calf, and your feet are free to interact with the treadmill down here. And then you can set the treadmill running. And this device will actually walk for you. If you want, it'll do all the walking, even for a person totally paralyzed. Or you can scale back how much it's doing and try to get the person to do more themselves. But the idea is that it moves the person through normal walking movements to give them that practice. And before these were invented, it took several therapists to sit on each side of the treadmill and take the limbs and put them through the motions. So it was a very expensive in terms of staff time, and people thought that would never catch on, to pay therapists to sit down beside a treadmill and move legs around all day in the hope that the person would get better walking. The alternative is then build a robot, which is also expensive. And so the question is then, does the cost of the robot match the benefits that you get back in restoring function? And that's still a subject of some research. There's some areas in which it doesn't seem to make a difference, others in which it might. But you generally have to have some wiring left, even if you're partly paralyzed. You want to have some intact nervous system that you can retrain for this theory to hold water. And then, of course, there's screens for the therapist to operate, something for the patient to watch while they're moving, whether it's to see themselves or just to watch a video if they're spending hours of practice. Yes, you can get a not completely precisely, but you get a pretty good idea for the spinal cord, which is because it's like a cable. You can determine at what point it's severed and get some idea of how completely it's severed. So the level and the completeness are the two main measures of the severity of the spinal injury. And so there's good imaging systems now, particularly MRI imaging. You can see the damage to the soft tissues of the spinal cord pretty well. The completeness, we can't see very well by imaging. We mostly have to do it by behavioral things. First, by clinical testing of movement and feeling, and sometimes by more objective measures of picking up electrical signals from nerves and muscles for EMGs, things like that. And also there's quantitative sensory testing now, where you can apply electrical stimuli to the skin and then turn up the stimulus until the person feels it, and then measure quantitatively at what point they feel things. And you can do that at every point on the body and plot graphs of the measure of their feeling. So we really depend on these sort of functional things to know how completely it's damaged. But because the spinal cord is like a cable, and you can define spinal injuries according to their level and completeness, they actually serve as quite a good research model, because it's easier to pinpoint the damage in a cable than it is in the computer. So for people who have a brain injury, where in the brain is the injury is a lot harder. It's like trying to diagnose a computer fault rather than a cable fault. And it's obviously easier to figure out where the cable fault is, or to figure out if you've made a difference to the cable fault. You can tell whether you've connected the wire or not, but whether you fixed the computer and got out all the bugs, that's a more complicated question. But it does mean that people with spinal cord injury are quite good research models for some of these kind of techniques that then could be applied to other nervous system diseases. Well, I think it's still fairly experimental. So, yes, it's not. Although the VA bought these really in response to the veterans coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan, they wanted to try to make sure that all the VA spinal units had state of the art that was second to none in the country. So they bought them for all the spinal units, even though it's not completely proven which patients benefit and how much they benefit. But they wanted to make them available so that veterans could use them. It doesn't seem to make much difference, as I say, to somebody with a complete paralysis, a complete spinal cord injury. And it's more likely to make some difference with an incomplete spinal injury, but also being looked at in brain injury and some other central nervous system damage.
Brain injury,
the brain injury, at least, it's more complex, but there's also more plasticity and more potential for rewiring in the brain. Sorry, you were going to say? The biggest number of injuries, or the most notable numbers, are really people who suffered head injuries. And they outnumber spinal injuries a lot, partly because we have better body armor now, and the body armor has prevented a lot of spinal cord injuries. But the improvised explosive devices have become more powerful recently in Afghanistan, and even though the vehicles are armored and are better armored, the devices are now powerful enough to lift up the vehicle and drop it on its head. So if you're inside the vehicle, you might drop on your head. And if you hit your head, you might also break your neck. So you might have a spinal injury. And we're seeing an uptick in spinal injuries from Afghanistan, probably because of these more powerful explosives. But still the brain injuries outnumber the spinal injuries, which is not the case necessarily from previous wars. And spinal injury as a subject really started with the Second World War and with Korea and Vietnam. and with a lot of gunshot wounds and explosives. And that's really where people learned to manage spinal injury. Now we're learning to manage head injury more from the current conflicts.
In the future, there's a new site you might
be building. Yes, you may see when you drive in or out the huge amount of construction here. And there's a new building being built for what's called polytrauma, meaning multiple injuries, although a lot of those multiple injuries include are mainly head injury. Even spinal injury patients, a large percentage of them have other injuries, broken legs, chest fractures, pelvic fractures, abdominal injuries. And so typically multiple injuries, if there's a force big enough to break your back or to give you a head injury, other things have got injured too. So the main rehab things we have in the VA here in Palo Alto are spinal injury, which has been here since 1972, this unit. Brain injury, which has increased a lot lately because of Iraq and Afghanistan. So this is one of the four level one polytrauma centers in the country. And the others are all out east. This is the only one really in the west until they build a new one in Texas. And then we have a blind rehab center, an amputee rehab center, and the geriatric rehab. And so there's and those are from the war, those are the main things: head injury, spinal injury, amputations, and vision loss. The other thing that sometimes is involved, of course, is burns. We don't really have a big burn unit here, but you've probably been hearing just recently about Haiti and the injuries there, and we've been in touch with them about the spinal injuries. And so far, as of about 2 days ago, identified about 50 spinal injuries. There's probably a lot more. But some of them have not survived already. And so there's an international effort underway to try and bring some of those people to the States and to Europe for their rehab. We passed by the office of a visiting professor from Sweden. And he's accepted two patients back to his spinal unit in Stockholm. We've been debating whether the VA can take any patients from Haiti. We're waiting. That's a political question. We're waiting for the answer on. But one of the biggest things in Haiti has been amputations, because in an earthquake, it's the falling buildings and the rubble, the concrete and the stone that fall on limbs, trap people, and they may be trapped for a long time, and they may get death of the tissues in the limb and need an amputation. So huge numbers of amputations. And one of our colleagues was there last week. He's actually a neurosurgeon, but he said he spent the week doing orthopedics, because nobody else was, and they didn't have any general anesthetic, so he did about 140 orthopedic operations that week, just using sedation. He used a drug called ketamine, which sedates you, just give it intravenously, intramuscularly. They didn't even have general anesthetic. Operating by flashlight in trees, in the open air, under trees in the open air, and doing what they can for Haiti. So, a situation like that, where at least 150,000 people killed, spinal injuries doesn't always make it to the top of the priority list. And the fact is, surviving a spinal injury in a place with so little infrastructure is a huge problem, because of all the other things you need to survive such a major injury. We are extraordinarily different in our technical resources, obviously, compared to them. And we're not sure how many spine injuries will survive from Haiti, but a few fortunate ones may get out and come here for rehab and then go back in a few months' time. But then there's going to be years, of course, of technology needed, and particularly it's going to be a huge amputee need and a huge prosthetic demand in Haiti for many years to come, because at least people survive an amputation and then they're with you for life. If people don't survive the spinal injury, then they're not there for the healthcare system. But typically, people are going to survive the amputation, and so they are very visible politically and medically. And that drive, very often, war and natural disaster drives these kind of developments.
There are a lot of people who want to do prosthetics in Haiti, but it's going to be months before the situation is such that they can do anything.
Yes. Yes, I'm sure. Just to restore electricity and water and sanitation and being able to do anything but the most basic things.
Where they are.
Yes, yes. It's a huge logistic issue.
So how recent is this robot in this building?
This robot? It just came about a year ago. Yeah. It's fairly recent. It was invented some years ago in Switzerland, but they were about $300,000. And so there weren't too many of them in the country. And then the VA bought 23 of them. And Yes. Restoration, a function with this kind of thing? We haven't seen a lot of data really convincingly yet from this. It's still undergoing research. I think what we are seeing, I just came out of a journal club where we were talking about how many people improve naturally, which you have to compare with how many people improve with an intervention, because some improvement happens with time in the first few months or the first year or two. And so you always have to be thinking, well, if you do an intervention, did I cause it, or was that going to happen anyway? And so that's the trouble. Sometimes with equipment like this, people get on it, and they improve, and then everybody thinks it's the machine that did it. Well, was it, or were they improving anyway?
You have to have a good research study.
You really do. And so you have to design so carefully to do that, to prove that it wasn't just the natural history. And the number of people improving naturally is getting better with better first aid, better helicopter resuscitation, blood pressure control, oxygen, fluids. So now a lot more people improve spontaneously. It used to be that when you were paralyzed, people said, that's it, what you've got is what you've got, and don't expect any improvement. Now that's changed a bit. Better early care, a higher percentage of people are improving. I think it probably is driven more by politics than by science sometimes. In other words, and also a certain amount of humanitarian intention. In other words, getting data on equipment like this and how much difference it makes could take years of good research. And sometimes for political or personal or humanitarian reasons, people say, well, let's use it anyway in case it helps. Now, that sometimes muddies the waters in research terms, but it's rather like we had to wait years before we knew whether cigarettes caused lung cancer or not. And some people would say, well, I don't know, the research isn't in yet, but I'm going to stop smoking now just in case. So in the same way, I think the VA felt, well, let's try it anyway and use it in case there's benefit. But you still got to have the data, otherwise you spend a lot of money, and then if it turns out not to be useful, people are a little bit jaded the next time some technology comes along. And that's the danger of throwing technology out there if it isn't useful or isn't proven. If it works, people say, we tried that, all that technology doesn't make a difference. You know, don't show me your gadget, I've seen gadgets. And so you really do have to show that it works to get credibility of using the technology.
Well, I think one factor, probably in research as to what works best and so forth, one important factor probably would be the patient's motivation. And I think of Haiti, where people are actually highly motivated, so that would be...
Yes?
Because, considering the survival rate after being
yes.
for so long, there's a lot of motivation.
Well, there's a certain amount of natural selection, perhaps, in who survives, too. And we always notice that with the physical disability, even if it doesn't depend on your brain being damaged, the personality you have before you're injured is the same personality you have after. So if you're a go-getter before you were paralyzed, you'll be a go-getter after you're paralyzed. And so that stands you in good stead. So if we're go-getters now, it'll stand us in good stead if we ever get more disability down the road as we age or have accidents. Let's move on just to a couple of other things, and then we finish up.
What are those red things up on the ceiling? Physical disabilities for TBIs, if they're stable, we'll put them on it and see how much
traumatic brain injury. So we'll take them and we'll see how stable they are, and we'll kind of use it and we'll modify the games. But obviously simple, but we'll get them standing.
Modify the games as in?
As in like
develop?
No, as in like the we'll take the easiest levels possible, and you know then we'll use little adaptive equipments or adaptive ways to use the handheld devices if they're not getting to it. We're not quite an engineer, so we don't get to develop the products, but we can use small adaptations to what we have.
And also, you being a therapist, you're on the needs end. So you can help to determine what would be useful, what's needed. And that's just as necessary as the engineering to figure out the human end, the social end of the socio-technical piece.
There's a lot of stuff that we're sitting there going, we wish we had this. We're like, someone needs to develop this.
So oftentimes,
it could be a student project next year.
There you go.
Yeah, and I'll think about that because I'm a teacher's assistant for our physical disabilities class, which is our spinal cord and amputation stuff. So
I think what we need is a sort of matchmaking program where you match the need, you know, and it works both ways because you see things and you say, I wish we had a gadget that would do so and so. And conversely, there are the engineers thinking, I have this gadget, I wonder if anybody needs it.
Technology is the need.
Yes.
Yeah. On the other hand, it's, the need from the user, but both of them are good approaches. So
you need translation in both directions. To meet in the middle. And
when I was at Children's Hospital, we had a form that said, I wish I had AIDS.
Yeah. There you go.
We gave it to everyone that came in. We had a whole book of stuff. So anytime students or volunteers.
That's a great idea.
Real
yes.
Needs.
Yes, that's a great idea. We talked of having a boat show once because you know people go to boat shows to choose a boat. And so you go and you want a boat, and you go and you look at all the boats and you go shopping. But sometimes you say, you say to the boat maker, I wish I had a such and such a boat. But the trouble is, if you just say to them, I wish I had such and such, often the engineer will say, yeah, I can make that. You know, and he goes away and comes back in 5 years and says, you know, here's this boat. And you think, you know, he built me a battleship and I really wanted a canoe. And so you've got to keep in touch. Just to make sure, you know, you keep reiterating the design and saying, is this really what we want or is it a little different, and so you can go through this design cycle multiple times.
It's one of the things I bring up in class that you have to have that connection with the ultimate user on a continual basis during development, and so that's a key issue in our design process.
Right. We often used to call the users the test pilots,
yes.
Too, rather than patients. You know, they're the test pilot who's going to give you feedback and tell you whether your design works, because if it doesn't work for him, he's not going
to
use it.
We also have to know how to use the technology, because we're generally teaching the patient or client. So we have to know it inside out in order to teach it to our people who are injured. So.
But it also reflects the fact that nobody's got all the knowledge. You may not have all the engineering knowledge, but the engineering doesn't have your clinical knowledge. So the only way to do it is by a team, by a network, because no one person's going to have all the pieces. And so you need the team to do this.
And the patient's part of the team.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah. Yes.
What's happening now with the globalization, that you know a lot of design work is happening worldwide, so that problem of staying in close communication during the life of a project or a piece of science is really important. So the goal is to try to make it feel like we are in this room together. So hey, have that kind of mission. And I don't think what I've seen is not super duper science. It's just a lot of common sense stuff put together in a smart way.
Yes, often it is common sense to find the appropriate level. But you're absolutely right, and collaboration is really the name of the game when you're innovating. I don't know if you've seen this book, Group Genius, which talks about our view of the genius is often it's the lone ranger. But actually, it's usually a result of a group process, and ideas came from a lot of places, and one guy may get the credit. But actually, creativity is often a group process, and that... Once you recognize that, you play to it, and you set up situations that foster collaboration. And you may not know what's going to emerge, but you create the collaborative environment and then see what happens. And people liken it to jazz. There's a lot of improvisation. You can't structure it and predict it and plan it entirely. You create an environment like you guys are creating. And then you never know what ideas are going to spark because it's a creative process. It's not... you know, predefined. If you knew what was coming out the other end, it wouldn't be creation. So you're right about the tools we have now allow us to collaborate at a distance in ways we never could. We're trying to set that up even just for patients here to have access to video conferencing just for themselves to keep in touch. And we've been to see Cisco and Sun and some of these people where they have this, you know, this high-definition video conferencing, virtual reality and telepresence. But you don't necessarily need that. Sometimes you just need the telephone or Skype or something. And then sometimes you really got to get together and have a cup of coffee. You know, it's not until you get together the back of the napkin that you really say, what I really wanted was a canoe. You had a CAD program and you designed me a battleship, but let me show you on this napkin the kind of canoe I mean.
The envelopes work well, too.
They do. The envelopes are fine. They're better, actually. I think this is just really some cushions and padding that are used for exercise, for people may lay over it and roll over it and balance on it or flex the spine over it. All sorts of exercise balls and the smallest different sizes of them over there. Just the kind of equipment that's... And really, places like this merge with gyms and health clubs. And more we're trying to get people actually out into fitness clubs, health clubs. You can come here when you have an injury. It's like going to boot camp and learning the skills. But the rest of your life, how are you going to be fit? You don't need rehab for life. You've learned to do what you can. Now you can stay fit by going to Gold's Gym or some other place down the road. And then you get back into regular society and meet all your neighbors. So we're trying to get people more back into regular fitness clubs. Let's go.
Leave is welcome to leave, and anybody that can stick around, we'll have a little bit more discussion. And you know, this is your one and only opportunity to talk to Dr. Creasy. He's a very busy guy, and we really appreciate his time. So.
Well, I hope it's not your only opportunity, because you know the doors are open on an ongoing basis. This place has been involved in technology development for years, and. Dr. Jaffe still works on projects and is often talking to patients here to try and get projects that patients come up with, to define the needs at the grassroots level of what people actually want. So there's that opportunity to continuing. But there's lots also we haven't seen. Just on a short trip, just a couple of things. When you break your neck or your back, then you cut the main cable from the brain to the body. Of course, you not only lose control of muscle and the voluntary movement, you lose feeling below that level, you lose control of bladder and bowel, for example, and sexual function, and blood pressure, and sweating. So it's not just the obvious paralysis. It's almost every body system that's affected when you cut the main cable. And it's not just physical, of course. It's mental, it's emotional, it's social, it's spiritual, it's economic, it's cultural. So the effect of a few milliseconds of injury on your spinal cord can affect the rest of your life and all your family and friends and so on, as you know. So it's a small pond, but a deep one. And so there's a huge opportunities for technology. Don't think that everything's been invented already. The main areas, obviously, are if you cut the nerves, it's a communication problem. So restoring communication is part of it. And so we talked about information technology because really the nervous system is functioning on action potentials in the nerves, little electrical pulses down the nerves that are very much like digital pulses. And so people are trying to work on jumper cables and ways of rewiring the nervous system and plugging electronic systems into the nervous system. This year at Stanford, they plan to put a chip in a brain of a patient with ALS, Lou Gehrig's disease, so that as he thinks, you can pick up the signals from his brain and use that to drive a computer or drive a limb or something like that. So plugging computers and electronic systems into nervous systems is something where we're just scratching the surface so far. We've used pacemakers, but you don't have to limit pacemakers to the heart. It could be for breathing or for bladder or for the arms or the legs or any nerve or any muscle. So that's one area of just trying to restore things. The biotechnology you mentioned is another focus at Stanford because of all the interest in stem cells. And as you know, California passed Proposition 71, and so there's a huge amount of money, about $300 million a year being spent on stem cells in California, which is not any more than any other state. It's more than the federal government. So it's more than any country in the world being spent just in California. And That's right. And a discovery they announced this week on taking skin cells and converting them directly into nerve cells without going via stem cells. So there's a huge interest in what genetic information allows us to do. Once we start to understand the information in the DNA, can we program cells to make them do what we want? So ultimately that might be another approach, and we hope this year to be involved in the first human trial of stem cells for spinal cord injury in the Bay Area and in several other parts around the country. But those are somewhat longer term. Right. And she probably had that done overseas.
She did it in India.
Right.
So
yes.
She did five different treatments.
Right.
And she actually recently tore her ACL, which is why she knows she can feel pain.
Right. Right. We had somebody speaking at Stanford last year, just a bit over a year ago. Probably not the same person from Colorado.
No. Amanda Boxtel.
Yeah. She spoke at the Clark Center in Stanford in April last year. And she talked about her experience in India. And she also talked about her experience with having a pacemaker for her bladder.
Yes, she's a close friend of mine, and she just recently,
about
a month ago, tore her ACL.
Right. So she's a pioneer who's tried both of those, the information technology and the biotechnology, and is striving to get back function. And she talks about it very, very actively. But there's obviously a lot you can do without waiting for connecting computers to brains or putting stem cells into spinal cords. the board we started out with in the hallway that was invented just on this campus. One of the simplest things you can think of, just a sheet of plastic that can actually make a significant difference and can be replicated and taken all around the country and around the world, taken to Haiti. They could use probably a few thousand of those in Haiti right now. And the kind of thing that are cheap enough that you could ship them to Haiti. So you can have a huge impact with sometimes a very simple device that doesn't require you to connect a computer to a brain. You just have to engage your own brain with the problem and find the appropriate technology and something as just as simple as that sheet of plastic could actually save thousands of lives and limbs in a place like Haiti. So it's partly, I think, a matter of matching your interests and your strengths to problems that you come across. It's finding that match, not only between the problem and the solution, but also between your talents and interests and the problems you're exposed to. Often it's because of a personal connection of people you know, people you've run into, things that have happened in your family or yourself. We all have disabilities of some kind or another. We all have some experience of different kinds of disability. And so how do you match up the particular resources and talents and skills and experience and knowledge and background that you've had just to create the connection between what you have to offer and what the world needs? And if you can put those two together, you might just hit a sweet spot.
Well, we had the Rehab R&D Center just across the street for a while, and we were working with a lot of technologies, and we actually came up with, not only we worked on backboards, we also worked on wheelchair cushions and robotics, and as I told you, I worked on the driver simulator project, and another walking project, and a project for people that are deaf and blind, and a wheelchair controller system that I showed to the first day of class. So we worked on a lot of stuff over there, but just doing the research is just one part of it. The other part is getting it out commercialized, and that's actually a much tougher issue. And we sort of went through that last week a little bit when Nolan gave his talk. But that's really hard, and that takes a lot of time and a lot of money to get things on the market. And the also that I had was that I, as an engineer, if I came up with something neat and interesting, that it would somehow automatically, by magic, get on the market and everybody would accept it. But that's not true.
Now, there's a huge amount of increasing knowledge about how do you get things out of research and into clinical or commercial or public use. And people sometimes talk about this valley of death, where inventions die. On the way, even good inventions don't make it across the valley sometimes.
From what you say, you don't have this sort of transitional.
Not a lot here, but not in this particular campus. But remember, we live in Silicon Valley, which is such an entrepreneurial culture that it's better than most parts of the world for thinking about startups and thinking about that compared to many other places. We have people who think differently here, and where there's not so much stigma attached to trying and failing, where there's a certain amount of venture capital. We have this spinal unit and another one in San Jose at Santa Clara Valley Medical Center. And plus, I mentioned the brain injury, the blind, the amputee center. So there are the clinical resources, and then you've got the world-class academic resources at Stanford. And the trick is, how do you make those connections? And it's the matchmaking between the need and the solution. But we're in a pretty good spot to do that, because there's lots of patients and there's lots of bright people, and we just have to create those connections, which is what you guys are currently doing. And if you have a truly good idea, then there is advice available too within Stanford about how to commercialize things, how to do market surveys and business plans, and how to approach venture capitalists, and how to get things across that valley. So it doesn't have to be a valley of death. It can be Silicon Valley, and they have more success.
There's actually funding available for a small business innovative research you can tap into that to help that process. And Stanford has the Office of Technology Licensing, and we also have another program that started up last year. It's SCETER program, S-C-E-C-T-E-R program, and that's looking at making the results of research available on, more globally, but I think they're more, may not be as into devices, they're more into concepts and drugs and things like that.
But the VA has a fairly strong emphasis, or a stronger emphasis perhaps than NIH, on clinical application and sometimes on development grants, not just hypothesis-driven pure research, as it's called. Not that the other's impure, it's just that I think the VA is a little more practically oriented because it has a mission for looking after patients and veterans. And so there are grants available and some awareness of technology transfer to industry. And they like to know if you invent something, they'd like to have the option of filing a patent on it. But they're not usually possessive about the patent, and so it's possible for the inventor to get some the royalties. And the VA is more interested in good publicity than in making money. And so if they get the publicity and you get the money and the patient gets better, everybody's happy. So it's not a bad place to develop things. But again, it takes this teamwork, a partnership with industry and with politicians and finance people. It's actually, yes, it's going through a bit of a revival now because it's being expanded. As you'll see if you drive by, they're building on an extension, adding another floor. There's a new director who has quite an interest in neuromuscular diseases. And so we're hopeful that there'll be increasing collaboration between that center and the clinical units in the hospital here. Because, once again, that's what you need. You need people to be making those connections. And one of my old mentors used to say that the doctor has to go into the workshop and get oil on his shoes, and the engineer has to come into the operating room and get blood on his shoes. Then you're working together. And then you start to understand each other, and you have coffee, and you pull out the napkin and the envelope, and you start to design things. So there's no substitute for that kind of matchmaking. And that's where the new creations are formed, just as in human families. It takes matchmaking to produce new babies. And so if you're going to produce children in the form of ideas and products, it needs the different genes, the different members of the community to make sure those children don't succumb to the valley of death. But there's hope.
R&D by acquisition.
Yeah.
It's really federally subsidized R&D because we get grants or small business innovation grants and so forth. So all that, it reinforces your getting your concept of getting together.
Right, and I think it's, so once we recognize that and realize it, then we can work with it. I think it used to be the people would say, oh, those business guys, they just want Uncle Sam to pay for the research and they want to make all the money. Or the business people would say, oh, those academic types, they haven't a clue about commercialization, they just want to write papers. But instead of throwing bricks at each other, if we actually got together, we could say, listen, we're good at the basic research, you guys are good at the commercialization, we should work together. And then you get these parts of the network working together. And then you can have that kind of healthy collaboration once you realize that I can't do it all, and probably he can't do it all. And so if we work together, we might get it done.
We want to see if this works with certain diagnoses. Do you have this diagnosis? Can you just try it out for us? We would definitely be willing to take it and go, okay, let's see how this works and just kind of try it out on just on an easy basis, on just a short term. And we do that every spring semester. So that, I don't know, that might be a...
Well, it could be very useful because you get to try out a prototype before the design is too frozen, and you sometimes find Mark 1 isn't quite right, and even Mark 2 isn't quite right, and maybe you need to go through several iterations trying it out before you freeze the design and say, this is it, we're going to spend $1 million developing it. You really want to do that field testing and tweak it a bit.
Just on that, though, I mean, isn't there a lot of liability with just testing it on?
Well, if it's something that might harm somebody, then you've got to take account of that, sure. And so if there's a risk to somebody, then they need to know. They need to be informed consent. They need to be informed and they need to give their consent. And there's all sorts of ethics now, if you're going to do formal research like that, to make sure nobody gets hurt. So you've got to, and that's just part of treating your neighbor ethically. You want to make sure that somebody doesn't get injured trying out your gadget. So there's a fair ways to go in making sure it's safe, even before you find out whether it's effective. So the first stage in a lot of these things, is what they call the phase one trial, is it safe? Before we even know whether it works. Then when it's safe, then we'll figure out, is it useful? And so you're right, you have to have a high bar yourself in your own conscience, and there's all sorts of regulatory mechanisms, at least if for formal research. But it's partly just putting yourself in the other guy's shoes and saying, now, could anybody get hurt? Is there anything we have to protect against?
We try all of our devices ourselves.
Well, there's a long tradition of people doing research on themselves, too. Part of the network.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it's useful to diagram all the players, and you just get a flip chart, and you just put, well, I'm here at San Jose State, and where are you, and where are you, and then who else are the players, and are there players who aren't in the room? Because sometimes you can't solve the problem without somebody else in the room. You know, maybe you need the guy with the big bucks, or you need the politician, or you need some other member of the network who's not there. And this sort of idea of using the whole system to solve the problem is sometimes more successful than trying to solve it without some key players. And then, so figuring out who the players are is part of the exercise, and it's interesting sometimes to just put everybody on a sheet of paper and then say, well, who talks to who, and who's connected to who, and who doesn't talk to who, and who should be talking to who. It's like a little mini internet, and you figure out not everybody has to talk to everybody, but maybe some people should be talking. So,
and if they're all crazy, you need a psychologist.
Right, or a marriage counselor. Precisely.
So we got to the point where a lot of the investment groups, are looking at this and saying, this is great, how I commercialize it. And it couldn't get through that valley of death.
Right.
There's a lot of technology.
So part of figuring out how to solve that is particularly acute when you're dealing with some disabilities that aren't very numerous. You know, spinal injury is not that numerous. They're not that many people, but they're pretty severe disability. So we did one startup company when I was in Cleveland that burned through $33 million and then went broke because they were trying to make a device just for the spinal injury market. And so then we thought, oh, that didn't work. Did another startup company, and we said, let's invent a device that would help people with spinal injury, but that could also help a lot of able-bodied people with a similar problem. There's 20 million people out there with incontinence. And, spinal injury people have incontinence too, but only a smaller number. So if we can invent something that might help 20 million people, then it might have a chance. So I came up with this idea. I put a little bit of money into the company. After about a year, they came to me and said, oh, if you sell out now, you can make 250%. I thought, that sounds good. So I sold out. And wouldn't you know, 2 years later, they sold the company to Medtronic for $41 million. So timing is everything. But the principle was they succeeded, at least in selling the company, because there was a big market that could subsidize a small market. So the able-bodied market could have as a piggyback the smaller spinal injured market. So if you can invent a device that lots of people can use, if you can invent an iPhone or an iPad that lots of people can use, and it just so happens people with disabilities can use it as well, then you have a chance of commercializing. And so it's part of good universal design, I guess, that it works for lots of people.
Right, yeah, we had a talk on universal design. But another thing, if your solution is software, then you're not building anything, you're not manufacturing anything except topic software, so that's an easy way to go as well.
Yeah.
So yes. If you have an application that would work in that same way for able-bodied people with disabilities, you're in good shape.
So you take a platform, right, like an iPad or an iPhone, and you write an app for it. And there's a very little.
Although I would say millions and millions of dollars on software that just used.
Nope.
It almost seems like, and I think they do kind of apply this in lectures, you almost need like another step in the design process, the normalization process. It says, let me take this very specialized, focused product or solution I have, let me now see if I can do something to normalize it, or maybe even take components out of it, but bring it to a level that it's
broader. Well, because of the iPad launch, I was reading an interview with Steve Jobs this week, and he'd been up, I think he'd talked to Amazon about the Kindle. And he said, well, the Kindle's great, but I think a general purpose device will sell more items. So if you don't just read books, but you also watch movies, and also listen to music, and also do all these other things, then we're talking a bigger market. And so, flexible, broad, adaptable.
There's a lot of functions together.
Yeah.
Carry just the one thing.
Yeah, not too specialized. Okay, well
thanks so much for
keep in touch.
To us, and I want to thank everybody for sticking around. It's really been enlightening.
Right.
So that's
me. Yes, so we hope to keep in touch because, we learn from you guys coming here too. It's great to have lots of bright Stanford folk bringing ideas down here. So it's part of this making contact. So let's keep it up.
Around every year, doing projects. So I'll make it my priority to be in touch with you and the folks here. And so we'll do our part.
As long as I'm here, you're welcome back.
Okay.
Good.
Thanks again.
Thanks for coming.